Welcome to the Liberty Education Interview Series. Today we're going to be talking to Gordon Chang, a best-selling author and speaker who lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost two decades. His writings on China and North Korea have appeared in numerous major publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the American Conservative, National Review, and Barron's. Mr. Chang also has been a frequent guest on Fox News, Fox Business Network, CNBC, PBS, the BBC, and Bloomberg Television. Gordon, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Robert.
Given what you wrote in your book, The Coming Collapse of China, how was China able to catapult itself into the second biggest economy in the world so quickly?
That's with the help of the United States and a very benign foreign environment. Yeah, I wrote a book in 2001 where I said the Communist Party would fall in a decade, so I'm out of time. What happened is in the 2008 downturn, China just decided to stimulate its way out of the problems, and it did so behind strong capital walls. But what's happening right now is China's economy is really in trouble. It's perhaps not growing much above zero, and it's having its 2008 downturn. While the rest of the world seems to be okay. China right now is in a difficult position because it not only has problems with its economy, but it's also got the trade war with the U.S., which is really a broader economic and struggle, and, of course, the problems in Hong Kong. So Beijing looks extremely fragile at this particular moment.
In your book, The Coming Collapse of China, you make the case that the Communist Party of China is China's biggest problem and will ultimately cause its collapse, which I found interesting. Why don't you give us an overview of why you believe this?
Well, I don't think that communism can survive in a modern environment as today. You know, to go back to your first question, China really had the support of the United States for four decades, starting with President Nixon's visit to Beijing in 1972. And the United States tried to integrate Beijing into the international system. That obviously has failed, as we see right now, and people are reconsidering engagement. We're moving towards a containment of China to protect ourselves. And I don't think that a Marxist-Leninist state, which is really what China is right now, can survive in a integrated open world. That's really the fundamental problem for China, especially now that Beijing is losing the support of the United States and others. I don't think it will be able to adapt. At this particular time, you know, China looks strong. In many ways, it looks stronger than the United States, some people believe. But we've got to remember that it's a much smaller economy than ours. It's an economy which is probably, in reality, growing slower than ours. It's a problem beset. It's a country beset by internal contradictions. I don't think that it'll be able to survive very much longer. You can see for yourself that Beijing has challenges that are greater than it can solve, especially as it's going back to a Maoism that I think is not going to create the support from others that is necessary for its survival.
What would you say are the most obvious signs that China's economic system is failing, Gordon?
We see a lot of money coming out of China right now. I mean, we can look at the economic indicators. They claimed 6.0% growth for the third quarter, but when we saw imports and exports both negative, imports are the most important because they show domestic demand. Imports are now down 5 months in a row. But we're seeing money start to come out of China again, as we saw in 2015 and 2016. That's a real sign of pessimism. Another sign of pessimism is that the Chinese are buying gold. That's informal capital flight for people who can't actually afford the international structures that are necessary to get money out of the country. You know, ordinary Chinese are saying, no, this is not working. We see it in the weakness of the currency. It's just across the board. There's one weak sign after another.
And I'm surprised you said that fleeing the country, getting their money out of the country, is that easily possible now with the Chinese repression? I'm surprised that people are able to move money around that easily.
Well, they are able to get it out, and they do it with over-invoicing or under-invoicing, depending on whether they're importing or exporting. They're carrying it out. And, you know, we saw, for instance, you know, In 2015, 2016, you had more than $1 trillion U.S. dollars in net capital outflow in each of those 2 years. They clamped down a lot towards the end of 2016, but right now money is coming back out again because of problems, evident problems in China. And this is perhaps most poignant when we saw the 39 people who died in that container in the U.K. You know, these are people who are desperate to leave. So this really shows that China is not able to create the economic growth that is necessary to sustain itself. And I think we're going to see more and more instances and signs of China's weakness.
Now, is everything that you're talking about here part of what you've referred to as the Great Regression in China?
Yeah, the Great Regression is a phrase which I wish that I came up with, but I didn't. And what it refers to is Xi Jinping, the current Chinese ruler, is doing two things. First of all, as I mentioned, he's going back to a state model of economy, something that Mao Zedong, the founder of the People's Republic, would be familiar with. So we're seeing much more state involvement and much less private involvement. And private is not only foreign companies, but it's also domestic Chinese private entrepreneurs. So this is something which is proven not to work in recent Chinese history. The other thing that he's doing is he's going back to a totalitarian social system. So, you know, people say China's authoritarian. I don't think that's appropriate anymore, especially with the social credit system, which by next year will give every Chinese citizen, according to their plans, will give every Chinese citizen a constantly updated score dependent on behaviors. People won't be able to send their kids to school or get mortgages or even travel if they have a low social credit score, as some Chinese right now are having trouble doing because of the local social credit systems already in place. We see this with the surveillance cameras. We see this with Xi Jinping demanding complete obedience. So this is a totalitarian system, and that's what they mean by the Great Regression, not only the economy but also social system in China, going back to something that we saw in the first years of the People's Republic.
I know you've studied President Xi a lot. Do you think he really understands China's potential problems?
I'm sure that he's confronted with them every day. He is generally considered, I think, inside of Beijing to be personally accountable for the problems. Under the old system, which existed between Deng Xiaoping, who was Mao Zedong's successor, through Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, the two succeeding leaders, China's system was more or less collective, which means that a general secretary, in other words, the ruler of the country, was not going to be in trouble if there were problems, because all the decision-making was consensus-driven. Now it's not under Xi Jinping, and for various reasons, including the fact that he's deinstitutionalized the Communist Party, he's basically out there on his own. So when China was doing well, as in 2016, 2017, this was great for Xi Jinping. He's getting all the credit. But now I think he's getting a lot of the blame for stuff, which is basically has nobody else to hold accountable. So as I mentioned, you had the trade war, the economy, problems in Hong Kong, and right now something that we Americans don't talk about, but which is the African swine fever, which has decimated China's pork population, probably reduced it by more than half, creating inflation, creating shortage of food. This is not a good story, and Xi Jinping is, you know, he's there, and he doesn't have anyone to blame.
Well, all this is going on with the economy. Does China still subsidize, or do they subsidize more state-owned companies, expensive privately owned companies, and are they still nationalizing private companies? All these problems, encouraging monopolies, where are they on all this? Do they see the light, or are they getting worse?
Well, I think the problems are getting worse. We're seeing, for instance, just to run through the recent developments, we've seen the merger of already large state enterprises back into formal monopolies under Xi Jinping's development programs like the Made in China 2025 initiative. There are more state subsidies. There's an attempt to actually increase state ownership of economic players, and that is reversing the partial privatization of recent years. So this is the Great Regression, or part of the Great Regression, where China is going back to an old model, which, you know, existed in the first 20, 30 years of the People's Republic. China's big growth spurt was when they tried to liberalize, and they actually succeeded. They unleashed the private sector. They unleashed the initiative of the Chinese people. This started at the end of 1978 at the historic Third Plenum. But now they're going back and undoing that. And you can imagine this is not good because state enterprises are just not efficient.
And, you know, I know when they entered the World Trade Organization, many analysts believe it was going to force them to open themselves to foreign competition, but it doesn't appear that that worked at all. I mean, that was a sales pitch that proved to be false, right?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that foreign companies would enforce their rights, and they didn't. China has been violating its World Trade Organization obligations, and that's been especially evident in recent years under Xi Jinping. So, for instance, just to give you one example that affects U.S. companies, China, as part of its accession agreement, agreed that by 2006 it would allow foreign payment processors into the Chinese market. That's credit card companies, basically. But up until now, the only one that's gotten approval is PayPal, and they haven't started operating yet. And what's happened is China's UnionPay, Alipay, and some others have grabbed the entire market. So even if China opens up to foreign payment processors, it'll be far too late. This is just an example of the failure of WTO to change China. China's moving in the wrong direction. And if you want to blame some people for this, you can certainly blame Chinese leaders. But I think you also have to hold accountable some individuals whose names are George W. Bush and Barack Obama, for not vigorously enforcing America's rights. We've allowed the Chinese to play us, and historians are going to look at our leaders and say, how did this happen? Why did we allow this? This is a failure of American leadership, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives. The American people ought to be mad at their political class.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, a lot of them are mad at Trump, and I find it amazing because from everything that I know, everything you've said, Trump's really doing a good thing by standing up to them, because sooner or later, I think it's got to be done. Otherwise, where does it stop?
Yeah, well, President Trump, you know, you had a number of people run for president who said, oh, they're going to get tough on China. And then when they got elected, they didn't. Now, that stopped with Trump, because Trump has actually moved against the Chinese in important ways. So, for instance, these tariffs, which are imposed under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974 as a remedy for the theft of intellectual property. Trump's done a lot of other things, putting Chinese tech companies on the Commerce Department's entity list, which is basically a death sentence if it's enforced. The Trump administration has moved in important ways. This is not to say that they've moved fast enough. Trump needs to do more, but it is to say that at least now we are progressing in the right direction because of the president's moves on China. So this is a really good thing.
From everything you read about President Xi, it seems like he has delusions about following Mao's footsteps and wanting the Communist Party to have absolute control of society again. And, of course, he wants to have absolute control over the party. Does it seem that way to you?
That's correct. Xi Jinping demands absolute obedience of the party, and he demands that Chinese society be absolutely obedient to the party. Xi Jinping has also been dropping hints that China's the world's only sovereign state, which would mean that we're subjects. He's got ambitions which are completely audacious. And just because they're ludicrous doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention to them. We Americans are at fault for not listening to what the Chinese say about us. So, for instance, you know, Xi Jinping, as I mentioned, has been having his officials talk about how China is sovereign and nobody else is. That's not exactly what they say, but that's where they're hinting. Just to give you an example, Wang Yi, the foreign minister, in September 2017 wrote an article in Study Times, which is the influential publication of the Communist Party. It's the Central Party School's newspaper. And in that article, Wang Yi said that Xi Jinping thought, and a thought in Communist Party lingo is an important ideological body of work. Wang Yi wrote that Xi Jinping thought makes innovations on and transcends Western international relations thinking of the last 300 years. So if you take 2017, you subtract 300, you almost get to 1648, which is the Treaty of Westphalia, which establishes the system, international system of sovereign states. When Wang Yi talks about transcended, he means no more sovereign states other than China. And we know that Xi Jinping has been using this language of China being the only sovereign state in his official pronouncements. Communist Party hires people to study how China can impose the tributary system on the rest of the world. This is really dangerous stuff, but we Americans are not paying attention to this. So this is our fault. You know, we can say Xi Jinping is a villain. He certainly is. Probably, in my view, he's the world's most dangerous figure, but he couldn't become the world's most dangerous figure if we actually tried to stop him, because we're so much more powerful than the Chinese. So this is our fault as much, not as much as, but this is our fault as well as Xi Jinping's, because we're allowing him to destabilize the world. So as I said, when historians look back, they're going to look at us like they look at the British and the French in the 1930s, when they said, how could Germany, which was much less powerful than Britain and France, start World War II? They started World War II because the British and the French had feckless policies. Well, right now, America, you know, at least up until the Trump administration, had really feeble policies too.
Boy, no question about that. You know, what concerns me is that no matter what China agrees to, Western countries, I don't think are ever going to be able to get them to stop stealing technology and intellectual property rights. That's the one I'm really worried about. What happens if Western companies just all of a sudden absolutely refuse to transfer technology to China, or it becomes a law in the United States? Given all of this, do you think there's any solution to China's theft of intellectual properties? Because I don't see that ever going away. And you can't trust their word, or even when they sign an agreement, right?
Right. I mean, China's never honored a trade agreement with us. So I don't see the reason why we're trying to sign up another trade agreement to remedy their dishonoring previous ones. That, to me, just does not make sense. We can stop China's theft of intellectual property, but we got to impose costs which are at least as great as the benefits Beijing receives. And since Beijing steals somewhere between $150 and $600 billion worth of U.S. IP a year, the costs have got to be enormous. And we've got to have the political will to impose those costs on China. The Trump administration has started in that direction, but has not moved, as I mentioned, far or fast enough. So there's a lot more that we need to do. Unfortunately, our president is under intense pressure from Wall Street, Chambers of Commerce, the Koch organization, multinationals, to give the Chinese a free pass. And we need the American people to put more pressure on the president to do the right thing. So this is a political issue of organization and getting the president's attention on this.
In the same vein, why don't you explain to our listeners what China's 2016 cybersecurity law is and the danger it poses to foreign companies, especially those in the United States?
This is a really important point, because on December 1st of this year, China is going to apply its 2016 cybersecurity law in full effect. And that means, according to the rules that have been issued, foreign companies operating in China will no longer be allowed to encrypt their data. They will probably be required to use Chinese servers. There are going to be intrusive inspections from China's government. And they're not going to be able to use virtual private networks, VPNs. These allow companies in China to access business information from websites that are not permitted to be viewed in China. So they allow companies, as they say, to jump over the Great Firewall, which is China's internet controls. So they won't have access to business information they need. And all of the data and communications they have in China will be visible to the Chinese government, which will undoubtedly take all of that information and give it to China's state enterprises so they can compete and put foreign companies out of business. So this is an important date. And I think that if China doesn't defer the enforcement of these rules, because we've been talking with China for quite some time about this, if they don't defer them, I think that the president, our president, should use his authority under the Trading with the Enemy Act and under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to just force American companies out of China. Because we know what happens when China gets their data, that China puts these companies out of business, like it did, for instance, with Canada's Nortel networks. So we can't allow that to happen. This is unfortunate and it's harsh, but we're not driving this. The Chinese are.
Of course, that leads to the biggest overriding question, which concerns me as a consumer, and that is, does the United States really need China trade at all? I know I have mixed feelings about it. I know I'm going to pay more for a lot of stuff if the stuff isn't made in China, but, you know, is it possible that places like Vietnam, Cambodia, and so forth can pick up some of that slack if the United States ever decides to totally cut off the trade with China?
Yeah, Vietnam, Cambodia, Bangladesh, Jordan, Mexico. Yeah, these countries are already picking up some of the slack. And China is no longer the low-cost producer in the world. So there will be a period, you know, 6 months, a year or so, where there could be a dislocation in prices. But not for very long, because prices will end up being cheaper coming from goods elsewhere. And the other thing, though, is that there will be certain disruptions which will be difficult for the United States to take. So, for instance, pharmaceutical companies have outsourced a lot of production to China. That will take a long time to replicate elsewhere. And that's a big issue, of course. The other issue is companies like Apple will be devastated because most of their products are manufactured in China. They will be able to move the supply chain out, but it will take some time, and Apple will get hurt. But I don't believe that the future of the United States, including possibly our survival, should be held hostage to the profits of one company in California.
Let's get back to Xi's ambitions. What is the Made in China 2020 initiative? Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, Made in China 2025 was announced in 2015. And it was an attempt for China to become self-sufficient and dominant in 10 tech sectors, such as robotics, semiconductors, and others. And then about a year and a half ago, they added an 11th area, which is 5G, the fifth generation of wireless communication, which is the Internet of Things, which is really important. So there's about 11 sectors which China believes it should dominate. The only problem with Made in China 2025 is that it's not compliant with China's World Trade Organization obligations. And so there is now this is the subject of the trade negotiations between Washington and Beijing. But we cannot allow China to dominate these technologies because it's not like they're competing with us fairly. If they compete us with fairly and they beat us, well, that's life. But that's not what's happening. China is stealing its way to the top, and so we have got to stop this because the competition is not fair.
Well, let's wrap this up by going to a couple of items that are not directly related to Chinese economy. The obvious one is, what do you think the outcome of the Hong Kong protests will be?
This is long-term warfare. You got two determined foes. You know, the Hong Kong police backed up by the Chinese. And actually, there are Chinese personnel, military or People's Armed Police, who are wearing Hong Kong police uniforms now. And on the other side are the young protesters who are dressed in black, also in riot gear, and they fight with each other most every day. Right, people in Hong Kong are, for the most part, putting up with the aggressive and sometimes violent tactics of the protesters, largely because there's a perception that, first of all, China's closed off all peaceful protests. Also, because people feel that this is the last stand for Hong Kong to defend their homes. I don't know how this ends, but I do think that there's going to be a long-term stalemate as these two sides fight with each other. And we got to remember that we've got an interest in this because the power that is encroaching on Hong Kong autonomy, which is the reason why these protests started, is also the power that's attacking our democracy. So we've got a common foe. And while the kids need us, we need the kids because we've got to protect ourselves. And these kids are fighting our fight, so we should help them.
Yeah, and I wonder what the United States and Western countries will do, what the reaction will be if China really goes all out, uses brute force to literally crush all these protesters. Because to date, there's been some restraint, but what if that's all off the table and it really gets ugly? What do you think the United States and European countries, for example, would do?
I think that we would sanction China, and I think the sanctions would be more effective than the ones that were imposed after the 1989 Tiananmen massacre, which were, George H.W. Bush told the Chinese secretly that don't worry about our sanctions, we've got your back, which is one of the biggest mistakes in American foreign policy. But I think we'll be better this time. But you got to remember that China may not have the capability of crushing the protests in Hong Kong, because this is not going to be 1989, where you had wide open boulevards in Beijing and people just threw themselves in front of tanks and armored personnel carriers. So it was a slaughter. In Hong Kong, you've got narrow streets, you've got tall buildings. Each apartment building is a fort for the kids. And these kids are going to go and they're going to kill a lot of Chinese troops. Casualties are going to be high, but not just Hong Kong protesters. It's also going to be the Chinese. So this will be very bloody. And it's not entirely clear to me that Xi Jinping is going to be able to commit, you know, what very well may be hundreds of thousands of troops for many, many years in order to quell the Hong Kong protests. So this is going to be a war, but it's not entirely clear to me that China's going to win it.
Wow, that's a big statement. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Just a couple more questions to wrap this up, Gordon. On the same subject, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the China NBA issue. Doesn't a true free marketer would ask, doesn't the NBA have a right to make a business decision as to the value of the Chinese market versus alienating American consumers? I mean, ultimately, aren't American companies going to have to make a choice, either take Chinese money and or business, or maintain a free marketplace of ideas? Isn't that what it gets down to?
Absolutely. You know, you're right. Businesses will do what's best to maximize profits. Businesses are amoral. We can't really expect them to be patriotic. And by the way, businesses are not charged with defining American foreign policy or implementing it. That's the job of the President of the United States. What we have seen is Xi Jinping has been demanding not only obedience of foreign companies for their activities in China. He's now trying to get them to implement Communist Party policies outside of China's borders. So this presents us with a choice that you just mentioned. That is, take Chinese money or maintain a free marketplace of ideas, but you can't have both. So it's we're going to have to make some very tough decisions, and I believe that we should decide to keep our democracy, which means I think that eventually the president will have to get our companies and our organizations out of China, because China is driving this. You know, this is really unfortunate. This is harsh. This is beyond what most Americans at this point are willing to accept. But when it becomes increasingly clear, as you know, what China is doing, I think Americans will understand that we've got to maintain our free institutions, which means getting our companies out of China.
In the case of an entity like the NBA, you've got a whole different kind of problem with all those players who, I think there's two problems. I think it's clear from listening to them talk that most of them have no idea what they're talking about. They're just underinformed. And number two, they have, they're making a lot of money in China. So there's got to be some education there for sure. Well, let's move on to the last question. Last thing I want to ask you. We've all heard a lot about China's re-education camps and horrible living conditions. Be honest with you, this bothers me probably more than anything else about China. So do you think any Western country should even be dealing with China so long as they're holding people in captivity and torturing them like this? Some of the things I've read are beyond disgusting, and it's pretty hard to see how you can trade with basically savages, because that's what their so-called re-education camps, particularly for the Uyghurs, sounds like. How do you feel about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is Third Reich stuff. These camps that China maintains are at least as bad as the ones that the Third Reich maintained up until the beginning of mass exterminations. We know that Uyghurs and Kazakhs are being detained for no reason other than their race and religion. They're being tortured. Their organs are being harvested. There is a gang rape, forced sterilization. This is horrific, and this is monstrous. We should have nothing to do with China. This is sort of, you know, what we're doing right now by having business relations is we're just enriching him so that he can enslave more people. This is absolutely morally wrong, and I think it's strategically wrong as well. You know, we look back and we say, well, how could, you know, Hitler have developed these camps? Well, it's because the British and the French and even some American companies were doing business with them. This is really, really wrong. It is morally wrong. It is strategically wrong. China has declared itself that they've got they declared a people's war on the United States in May of this year. We've just got to listen to what these guys are saying and start defending ourselves.
Before we wind this up, I want to pass along to everyone Gordon Chang's Twitter handle. That's Gordon G. Chang. Gordon G. as in George, Chang, and be sure to visit. Gordon, I want to thank you for joining us today. A really great interview, and I'm sure everyone learned a lot from your insights on China, and I hope you come back and visit with us again real soon.
I would love to, so thank you very much.